You're listening to the Men Overseas Podcast, a show that explores methods and ideas to help you live a bigger life. You will hear interesting stories of how people live, how they save and invest their money, and why having time wealth is better than being a billionaire. If you are entertained, educated, or elevated, be sure to hit the subscribe button. We're just getting started. Now here is your host, Brad D'Antonio.
LB, that's what I call you.
Big bro.
Yeah, I call him LB for little bro. How much time we spent on the phone, LB?
You just said 500 hours. I don't know. We've been working 2.5 years.
What do you think of the retreat so far?
It's been good, man. I think one, just the opportunity to travel to a new country, I think is a huge blessing. Like I said this last night, you know, I think not a lot of people get that opportunity. So even for you to, you know, put this together for us to travel and get here is cool. But I think there's something so powerful about being around like-minded people and learning. And the conversations here are way different than normal conversations I'm going to have spending time with people. And so I think it's been inspiring, motivating, but I just think learning from other people and life experiences, and it elevates you, I think has been the benefit of it. And I've already had some takeaways that have been profound. And so I'm excited to keep going. And yeah, it's been a good time.
Cool. Who would you say you've connected with most, and maybe somebody you'll keep in touch with when you leave here?
I think I've connected with everyone in different ways. I think talking with Tank has been fun. I think one, we're both hit it off on wearing the whoop. We're both into health metrics and stuff like that, working in sales and the medical community, medical industry, but then also our faith. Like our faith's very important to us, and just kind of diving into our faith and how it guides us and things that we've learned, I think has been really fun. So I'd say that we probably had the most in-depth conversation, but everyone, I feel like, you know, there's a lot of, obviously being coached by you, they're all studs. So I think there's synergies with everyone. So it's, I feel like I've connected with everyone in different ways.
So you mentioned your faith. Do you feel like you've matured, or like your faith has grown through the years, or do you become more, do you ask more questions of doubt? Like not doubt, but you know, we all stray from our faith at times, and I think in our discussions I can tell that yours is really, really strong. Have you always been that way, or how do you see your journey? Has it been linear?
It definitely hasn't always been that way. It's definitely a long story, but I do think that Jesus has led me to different truths at different times in my life, and I feel like there's been growth that's been slower, but then there's been exponential growth at different times, and ultimately I feel like he's leading me towards that. But yeah, I feel like it's definitely, yeah, it's grown a lot over the years. I haven't always been that way. It wasn't something that was always important to me, but I feel like Jesus pursued me and helped change me in different ways. It's been pretty profound.
Did you go to a Christian college?
I went to only Christian schools my entire life.
I didn't know that about you.
Yeah.
Wow, so you probably never deviated the way I did, because I was raised Catholic. And in eighth grade, I was removed from Catholic school. And I would say initially, whereas I had a habit of going to church twice a week since I was tiny, suddenly that was taken away. And I guess I could have gone on my own, but I wasn't driving yet. So I would say that is when I most strayed from my faith. Have you ever had a period like that?
I don't know if I ever strayed. I think it was always there as an underpinning in my life. Like it was always something that was there. It was always something I was very mindful of. I do think it started to become more serious to me in college. But I do think as I progressed through life, I think just hardship, or I went through certain things that the only place I could turn to was my faith. And I was transformed in some pretty profound ways because of that. And so, I mean, yeah, I've messed around. I've been dumb and stupid and all that. For sure, college, did all the college things, but yeah, I think it's always been there, and I feel like God always had a plan for me. Like even since I was young, it was like even if I strayed, I felt like I knew God had something for me, whatever that was, and so it was always in my mind. So yeah, I kind of a hard one to answer, but it's definitely gotten more serious to me as I've gotten into when I went to college, and then as I became an adult.
My parents put me in Catholic school. And it almost felt like they put me in school to prepare me for what would come later. That was mostly their doing. I hate to say that.
Yeah.
Did you have a similar experience?
So I've always been kind of anti-authority and rebellious, to be honest with you. And I think given some of the hard stuff I went through, like with my family and with my mom and with my dad, I think it was pretty paramount for me to be in that environment. Not that I adopted it or took it on full head, but I think it gave me a framework and guardrails for a very important time in my life where I think I could have gone off the rails. So for me, I think it protected me until I was able to then own it myself and live into it. But yeah, it did give me a framework from like a belief perspective and knowledge that I was then able to apply and really grow in and understand. So it did give me that baseline. But I think for me, it was guardrails for me growing up because I could have gone, I almost got kicked out of my school in seventh grade. Like I was just always getting in trouble and stuff like that. But I think that environment allowed me not to fully just kind of go off the rails. So I'm incredibly blessed for that. So it definitely helped in that.
So it was important for your parents to put you in a Christian school?
Yeah, there was no debate. Yeah.
Because they were raised that way?
Yeah, I think they just wanted the values instilled in me, which I appreciate.
You're engaged.
I'm engaged.
You got a day set?
May 31st, 2026.
What is that? Over a year?
So it's about now? It's about 13 months now.
You better keep your feet covered because they tend to get cold. I'm messing with you.
Yeah, I've been wearing some booties, some Uggs from time to time just to, yeah, to keep things warm.
You've been the only one walking around the house here with bunny slippers. Yeah. Like, what's going on,
That's
dude?
The reason, yeah. That's the reason.
Do you plan to put your kids in Christian school someday?
I don't know.
Is that something you thought about?
I thought about it a little bit. I think we need to dialogue about it. It's just part of it's where we're living, right? I don't know what the school system's like, where we're going to be at. So I think all the things will play into it. I think there's a benefit of both. I do think that there is a value of getting different viewpoints and opinions and beliefs. Like I never was really around that growing up. So I think it solidified me in my own beliefs, which I appreciate, and had a knowledge that was cemented into me. But then also, I think I'm just now getting into that process of trying to expose myself to other beliefs, opinions, whether that's religion, whether that's political. Like, I feel like now I'm getting exposed to that. So I do think there would have been some value to that growing up, where I think I got a little bit narrow-minded and I just wasn't exposed to things. So I don't know. It just really depends on, yeah, where we're at, what the school system is like. But I would ideally like my kids to have more exposure to different types of people.
And where you're at now is Nashville.
Nashville, Tennessee.
Tell me about what took you to Nashville.
My singing career.
You're a country music star?
Yeah, country music star. No, yeah, that's what I always tell people because that's why everyone moves there. But it was completely a God thing. I didn't know anyone in Nashville. So the build up to it was I felt less and less at home in Portland and I wanted to move somewhere. So Dallas, San Diego made logical sense because I knew people, I had family there. And my buddy, when I was looking into some spots, he goes, what about Nashville? That sounds kind of cool. And I'm like, I know nothing about Nashville. I didn't even know where it was on the map until I started driving out. And I put it in. I'm like, this is way more east than I thought it was.
Oh my goodness.
I didn't even know that. But basically, I had prayed. I said, God, you know, I established in my life whatever big decision I wanted to make, I wanted God to make it obvious. And if I didn't feel like it, I wasn't going to make a decision. So I said, hey, make it obvious where you want me. And I think I'm dumb enough where he just has to hit me over the head a few times and just make it very obvious. But it was kind of crazy. After my buddy said Nashville, it was day after day of Nashville coming up, even to a point where a guy at the gym overheard me on the phone, walked up to me and goes, did I hear you talking about Nashville? I just moved from Nashville. You would love Nashville. And so right then that like solidified it for me that I think this is where I'm supposed to be. And so it was so seamless and so easy. And that's why I felt very confident in it, where I posted, it was like a dating profile. Basically you have to like go to this Facebook page and put a picture of yourself and like what you're like, which felt kind of weird, but guy reached out to me, you know, ended up being a really good fit. He found the apartment. I had to do nothing. I signed the lease. I packed my car up as much as I could and I drove out. It's been a huge blessing. I met my first day with my fiance was 6 days in.
Wow.
So it's been a huge blessing. And I think we've talked about this a little bit of, I think there's a lot of power of getting out of your hometown, of going somewhere where you can fully be who you're growing into. And I think being at home, I wasn't able to do that as much because I had my friends that were still around. They still knew me when I was younger and made dumb decisions and they knew you as your old self. And so, you know, I think there's been a lot of power to me moving out there. And I think that was part of the reason why I was called to Nashville, where I knew no one. And so I could grow more there than I think if I went somewhere where I knew some people.
Wow. How many hours from home did you go?
So I took a long ride. I went from Portland to Utah, stayed a week. So that was probably 10 hours. And then I drove from Utah to Dallas, stayed with a friend. That was 2 10-hour drives. So that's 30 hours at that point. And then I drove up to Nashville, which was another 10. So 40 hours of driving.
And you moved there on a whim based on somebody suggesting, hey, you should move to Nashville?
I think in my life, there's been certain moments where I feel very clear on what I feel like God's called me to do and where he wants me to go. And so that was one of those things that I had positioned myself in a place of, okay, what's the next breadcrumb in my life that God wants me to do? And so I'd kind of prime myself from an element of faith of saying yes to certain things, even starting to work with you. Our first call was in Utah on my drive out. Like we did our discovery call. Yeah. Where it's like, hey, is this going to be a good fit? I was in Utah. Whoa, I remember at my buddy's house. Yeah. And so I was driving out, but there's little things that came into my life that I didn't really pursue, but I felt, I was like, I'm just going to say yes. I'm going to say yes. So that built my faith. And so then when I felt, hey, move to Nashville, and I feel like it was confirmed through just random sources of it always coming up, it was just easy for me to say yes. And I was pretty confident. I said, I'm going to move out there a year before I even moved. And I think people thought I was lying. Because, you know, people say that, hey, I'm going to do this thing, and they never end up doing it. But I was like, no, I'm going to move. But there was some stuff I was working through, health problems with my grandparents, and moved out a year later.
Did you have a job lined up?
Remote work. So made it easy.
Remote work for the job you still had in Oregon?
Yeah. So okay. I was working in a remote capacity, and that was one of the small yeses that I said. And that's what's crazy of living a life of intentionality. When you say yes to one thing, you have no idea where that other yes is going to go to. So like, for example, even how I got connected to you was me saying yes to working closely with our buddy, Jesse Corrigan. I had no idea that would lead to me working with you. And now I'm in Costa Rica. Had no idea. Right. But what was the question?
I don't know. What were we talking about? We're just going with the flow.
But I think my faith had been built of That's saying those yeses. About. It isn't?
Mm-mm. We were talking about the distance from Oregon and whether you had a job.
Oh, yeah.
But that just tells me that faith is always a part of your life and your thoughts.
Yeah, I think. And I like that about you. But no, we were talking about faith. You're wrong. I'm gonna correct my coach. I'm going to correct my coach here. Because it came back to.
This happens often.
Me saying yes was an act of faith for me to even take a remote job. Not knowing, I just took it because I was excited about the company. But then that remote job, I don't think if I would have had to find a new job, I would have moved. Realistically, the logistical aspect of it, but because I had a remote job, that didn't matter if I was in Portland or Nashville, it was easy for me to move. So like a small yes I made before opened the door for me to say yes to this big move.
And you moved into an apartment by yourself?
No, I found that guy on the Facebook group. He just like reached out to me and I was like, he doesn't seem like a killer, I don't think. He could
killer,
murder
like,
me.
In the workplace, or he's not going to murder you?
I mean, both. No, you know, he was an athlete. He's a trainer. He's a believer. So I was like, he seemed like a cool guy. So if I was going to roll the dice, it seemed like a good roll.
You still alive?
Still alive, from what I think. Nothing crazy happened,
and
what I know.
And then tell me about your journey from there. Did you find another job? Did you want to buy a house? What happened?
Yeah, so I didn't want to find a new job, so that's been a huge blessing for me is what I do. But yeah, I ended up, I think the biggest thing was in working with you, I wanted to diversify my portfolio and invest. And so one of those next steps was to buy a house. So I bought a house, I don't know, a year and a half ago. But that was something, yeah, just working with you that kind of helped me start thinking on that net worth perspective. Because I remember you started correcting me early on when I was speaking in terms of savings. You're like, I want you to start thinking in terms of net worth, which then started to change how I started to look at my money. So yeah, so I moved there, same job, but then about a year later bought a house.
And did you buy it by yourself?
Yeah.
And did you get a roommate?
I'm renting out one of the rooms.
Have you always done that?
At my house that I own?
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's impressive.
Yeah.
You maintain the same tenant?
Yeah.
For how long now?
17 months.
Have you ever referred to what you do in that sense as house hacking?
Yeah.
You have?
Yeah.
Because I started out that way, and that wasn't a phrase, that wasn't a term back then. And I've never heard you use that term.
Really?
Yeah. In fact, I forgot you had a roommate.
Yeah, I have a roommate. Yeah, I mean, to me, it made the most sense in the world. It's like, I'm going to rent this room out. I don't want to pay a full mortgage by myself. It doesn't make sense to spend an extra $1,000 a month. I'm going to reduce my expense per month. By buying a house, I'm going to rent out the room, plus I'm building equity. So it made all the sense to me, and it was funny. Because I was trying to fill the room, because at first, like, where I posted was on a Facebook group. Because a lot of people, if they're, I don't know, you get some interesting people looking for rooms on a Facebook to live with someone else, right? And so you're getting all these interesting people hitting you up. And so this one guy was, who's now living with me for 17 months, it's been a really good fit. He's a cool guy, but, you know, he was kind of hesitant, or he didn't know what he was going to do. So I kind of rolled the dice. I was like, and who knows what he's going to end up doing? But I said, hey, you can go 3 months and then go month to month from there. Mm-hmm. And that'll at least give me some time before I even knew him. Obviously, we've gotten closer, so now we're friends. But, you know, I was like, that gives me some time to kind of get someone in there, help pay the bills, and then I can find someone else. But he stayed for 17 months.
You've had him on month to month for 14 months now?
Yeah.
Did he sign a contract?
He hasn't cashed in on it. Yeah, it was a contract signed. Yeah. He hasn't cashed in on it, but he could at any time.
You're like the 30th of the month every month. You're like, hey, bro, I don't need rent. We first need to sign another a month-long lease.
I mean, ultimately, man, I mean, he's a good guy. And I think if he ends up moving, I think it's for a job change. And so I think that would be good for him if he wants to make that move. So I'd be fine if at this point, if he moved out. I want what's best for him. But yeah, I mean, I was a little nervous about that. But at this point, we're friends. So I think I don't think it's going to end poorly.
Are you friends to the point where sometimes you stay up late talking about life?
I'm usually, a lot of times, I'm going to be with Elise.
Do you think about how that might bother your roommate? And have y'all talked about that? Having a girlfriend over?
I mean, I told him when he moved in that she'd be over probably, you know, 3 evenings of the week. So we had that conversation. But we have had some deep talks when, you know, I'm just staying at the house and I'm not with Elise, or she's not over, or I'm not over at her house for the evening. But we've had some.
So you met your fiance 6 days into your move. How long before there were 3 toothbrushes at your new place?
I take care of my teeth, man. I got 5 for myself. So
okay, what about the 7th toothbrush?
I don't remember the timeline on stuff. Probably. I mean, I'm very intentional with dating, so
sometimes he doesn't want to answer that question, folks. Let's move on.
I don't know. It was probably a few months, 3 to 4. But it's not something that I would, even that, I don't take that lightly. So probably about 3 to 4 months.
You did something interesting lately. You said you went to the SEC basketball tournament. Who were you going to see play, and how was that?
I hardly remember who was even playing. I saw who was playing. Ole Miss played. I don't even remember, man.
Good seats?
Yeah, we were low. We were low in the bowl. But yeah, it was the first round. So it was Wednesday evening of the SEC tournament. They were like $25. So me and my buddy were just like, if we're going to go to any of the games, it's cheap. We'll go. So we got tickets. It was fun. I'm trying to even remember. I know Ole Miss. We saw the guard from Oklahoma, who was legit. He's going to be a lottery pick. We saw Mississippi State was not that good. But yeah, the good game was Ole Miss and Oklahoma. And then the other game was trash. LSU played, and it was bad, man. People from Louisiana, I don't know what they're teaching them down in that state, but it was some bad basketball.
Yeah, the first game I ever went to was 1987. They were playing Florida. Okay. And Vernon Maxwell was one of the guards at Pete Maravich Assembly Center.
Wait, where did Vernon go? He was LSU or Florida?
Florida.
Oh, okay, so you got smacked.
Yeah.
LSU got smacked, probably.
I believe I'm telling the truth. I don't know. I have an old program. I'll have to go and look. But Vernon Maxwell was one of my favorite players because I'm a Rockets fan. He and Patrick Beverly, they D up.
Oh, Beverly, man.
I love scrappy people like that.
Were you bummed they got rid of Beverly?
Yeah, and I hated when, I believe he played on the same team as T-Mac.
Yep.
And T-Mac was a scorer, and especially late in his career.
I think he was Harden. He was Harden.
Oh, that, yeah, you're
Beverly
right.
Was Harden.
I didn't like Harden either because he didn't play D. I like guys who play D. And I know you're a scorer, which is why you're LB, little bro. I was a scorer too when I played when I was 9. But I didn't like to play defense. I didn't like to foul people because one time when I was, I think I was 9, I fouled out of a game and I remember crying. And I never wanted that feeling again.
Mm.
Just not being able to play.
Yeah.
So I wasn't as aggressive as I should have been.
Yeah, I think my focus was definitely on offense, for sure. I think physically, like, I played collegiate basketball, obviously, but my gift wasn't lateral quickness. So, there was a limit there to some degree, but yeah, man, Houston team, I used to be a big T-Mac fan, so I even bought those little wristbands he used to have, so him, Yao Ming, the team was sick, but yeah, Harden, I like Harden, probably one of the best. I can make the argument he's the best offensive player of all time. People might think I'm crazy, but what he did offensively is unbelievable. They were guarding him from behind.
Well, what do you make of that dub step or whatever they call it that he invented where it looks like a travel to an old man like me?
Oh, the Euro step?
There you go.
Yeah, it's a travel. It's just 1-2. So instead of going 1-2 up, you just change your direction of that second step. I mean, he did some stuff, man, the setback, jump shot. But, I mean, if anyone, you force the defense to try to get behind you and force you to the basket. It's pretty nuts.
That is cool. And he doesn't even look quick. You know, he's not.
He looks out of shape. Right. All the time. Yeah, it's crazy. But
I wonder what he looks like without a beard. Have you ever seen that?
Have you not seen this?
That'd be like J.D. Vance without a beard.
I wish we could pull it up. I wish we had a screen. But there was my buddy actually had a post that went viral. So it's when he was Oklahoma City. He posted this on Twitter. And it was, if you get him smiling, he looks like a character from Cars. With his teeth kind of all messed up, but without his beard. It's a weird look. Yeah, it's I think he looks better with a beard,
he
for sure.
He was a sixth man on that OKC team, right?
Yeah,
he was a
sixth man. And then, obviously, he left and got paid. But in hindsight, they probably should have kept KD and Harden.
And not Westbrook?
You can make the argument.
I watch Westbrook play, and of course I love him if I love scrappy defensive
He's a dog.
Players.
Yeah, he's a dog.
I look at that dude, and I'm like, his career won't last more than 5 years. He looks like an NFL running back whose lifespan is going to be about retiring at 30.
Yeah. I love Russ, just like the effort he brings to the game. I think that's a lost art right now. It's just, it's crazy that that stands out playing hard every single night, but he's done that. I think he's been a great ambassador for the game. Yeah.
I ever tell you this story? I went to Vegas. This must have been 2014, and I was staying at the Wynn, which is a pretty swanky hotel.
Yeah.
And it was July. I want to say it was around the 4th of July weekend. And I thought nothing of it. And I'm walking by the blackjack table. And all of a sudden, there's this dude who looked like Mutombo walking through the crowd in the Congo. Because he was like this massive, skinny black dude with like 30 people around him. And it was Kevin Durant. And I'm like, what's he doing here? And then one of those 30 were John Wall and Russell Westbrook, and they were just walking among us without any security. So they walked right by me, and it happened to be the Olympic trials weekend.
Oh, yeah.
So Christian Laettner was a coach. Of course, I have great memories of that because the shot that he made, and you know, I remember where I was sitting and all that.
Legendary.
You know, the reason I asked you about the SEC tournament is because of your the seats you had. You got to sit next to Danny Ainge by happenstance.
Yeah.
And you told me that was one of the top five happenings in your life. It was like the best thing
the
ever.
The euphoria after that for me was crazy. I was riding cloud nine for probably 48 hours. It honestly was one of the cooler moments of my life because I'm a huge basketball historian. I mean, I listen to multiple podcasts a week. I just love the game. I grew up loving the game. And so, yeah, I'm sitting there. My buddy goes off to get some food and a drink. And so I'm sitting by myself. A couple people walk out. There's two seats available. Hey, are these seats taken? This one is. So they leave. Then some guy walks up. He's got a hat on. He goes, hey, is that seat open? Or is one of these seats open? I said, oh, this one's taken, but you can take the other one. Not thinking much of it. And he sits down. I look over and I'm thinking, this is 97% chance. I'm confident this is Danny Ainge. But he had a hat on for one, so I wasn't completely sure. But then also, it was just the fact that he was sitting there. I just didn't believe it. I didn't believe he was sitting there. And so I needed to confirm it just to make sure my eyes weren't lying to me. So he sits down, and he initiated a conversation. Are you here rooting for anyone? I'm like, oh, I'm just here watching. What about you? He's like, just here to watch. I was like, oh, I didn't catch your name. What was your name? And he kind of smiled and laughed, like not – he was incredibly humble, but he's like, my name's Danny. I'm like, Mr. Ainge, it's good to meet you.
You said that?
No, I should have.
You shook his hand.
In hindsight, oh yeah, I shook his hand. But he knew my grandpa from, because my grandpa played, and then I found out they were at the same country club.
What's your grandpa's name?
Terry Dischinger. Yeah. But I think to me, what I get really fascinated by is when you think of Danny Ainge, he is probably a top 3 to 5 executive, I would say, in the last 30 to 50 years, you could say, of all time in the NBA. So you're talking to someone that has been incredibly successful, not only as a player, he was an all-star, he won multiple championships, played with Larry Bird, Charles Barkley. So very successful as a player, but then also as an executive. So for me to sit down with someone like that who worked at the highest level in the game that I love, but it was also very successful. It was so fascinating. He was incredibly gracious with us. We sat and watched two games with him, probably talked to him for, you know, 2 to 3 hours, and he was very open. And so to be able to pick his brain on stuff was crazy, just to like, how does he process things? Who's the hardest person he guarded? What'd you think of the Luka trade? Because they were involved in that trade. I mean, so many different things. It was so cool, man. I wish I could go back and relive that, because me and my buddy afterwards were texting back and forth of, hey, let's make sure we remembered everything we talked about so we can go back and reference it. And then we were like, what did we not ask about that we should have? And we didn't ask about Larry Bird. Huge miss, right? Huge. You're talking about someone who isn't that public. So that's it. That was a huge, huge miss. But yeah, man, he was incredibly gracious. And for me, I was like, as long as he's giving us stuff, and you can tell he's not giving us the cold shoulder, and like, I'm digging in on this. I'm going to keep asking questions. Like, I even asked him what makes you the executive that you are? Like, why are you different from other people? And just getting his response to that was pretty cool. It was interesting. It kind of wasn't what I expected. He talked about, one, you have to get lucky in the draft, which is true. You never know how players are going to pan out. You have to get lucky. You got Jason Tatum, Jaylen Brown. That's a championship, right? Do those guys hit or not? You know, you can be somewhat confident. He said that, but he said top-down alignment between coach, middle management, ownership. Mm-hmm. So his role as a GM, the coach, and the ownership being on the same page and how important that is. And he was actually giving examples of other teams that like may not be doing that and the reason why they're not winning. But I think ultimately, man, I mean, he's obviously incredibly smart, but the thing is, he loves the game. He was sitting there while we're talking, he's watching the game, he's talking about the game with us, and he constantly had a game on his phone. So he's watching the Celtics play the Thunder. That game finishes, he moves to the Utah Jazz game because he's a consultant for the Jazz. Then he's flipping back and forth, looking at scores, he's watching end of college games. And I'm like, this dude just loves basketball. Like, that's probably the reason why he's successful. But yeah, man, one of the coolest experiences of my life, for sure.
Did you ask him about the GOAT? Because that's what I would have done. And if
I did not. I did not ask that question.
Okay, did you ask him about Michael Jordan, young one?
I asked about Michael.
Oh my God. Who the hell is the GOAT if it's not Michael Jordan?
Oh, no, he didn't comment on that. I said, who's the hardest person you had to guard? He said, quickest answer, Michael Jordan.
Was he like, stupid question, bro?
Kind of, yeah. He was like, of course it was Michael Jordan. And I said, Michael aside, who is the hardest people you had to guard?
You heard Michael Jordan out of his mouth? That's pretty cool.
Looking back, I don't know. I don't think he said Michael.
What did he say?
He might have. He might have said Michael or Michael Jordan. He's like, Air Jordan was the hardest person to guard.
2-3, always 23.
It was funny because those two golf a lot together. So I don't know if you know the story before the Celtics played the Bulls in the playoffs. So this was when Jordan, he didn't have the team, but they played. He played Bird in the Celtics, and they got beat in probably 5 or 6 games. But Jordan just showed out in that series. And so
I do remember that. Was that when he went through the legs on the baseline?
Yeah, Bird against guarding Bird. Him? But the story going into it, so him and Danny played 36 holes of golf, I think, the day before one of the games. And Danny beat him.
And how he much said, money? You should have asked for how much money.
I didn't ask how much money. I didn't want to interrupt the story. I'm like, you can keep talking.
They were playing for money.
Oh, they're playing for money. And they get back to wherever they were going from, and he goes, hey, Danny, tell Dennis I got something for him. And he went out and scored 62 the next game.
That's what he had
so
for
he
him?
So he used that as motivation to score 62. And obviously, the other players were like, what the hell, Danny? Like, yeah. What are you doing? But yeah, he said they play golf a decent amount, which is kind of cool, and he says he beats them more often than not.
There's so many stories of teammates opposing Jordan when they play the Bulls that are like, don't piss off Michael.
Yeah, don't, but he would create stuff, Jesus. Which is crazy. He would create stories to get pissed off. So whether you gave him something or not, he would like make up stories.
I know.
Just to get pissed off. Which I don't know. He doesn't seem like an incredibly happy guy, but I mean, he's the GOAT for sure.
That's interesting. Does anybody who has a lot of success, like the top dogs, like Brady or Jordan, or give me another example, Barry
Tiger
Bonds,
Woods.
Tiger Woods, do they seem happy?
It's hard,
right?
I don't know how possible it is, because I think you have to sacrifice so much. And I think to be that driven, you have to have something driving you. And a lot of times it's not healthy, in my opinion. And I think to be so consumed with something, I think there's power in holistic success. Are you succeeding in all areas of your life? And that is what leads to a great life and happiness and joy. And so I think to be that good at something, I don't know if you can be that driven at one thing and be fulfilled.
Yeah, now I'm curious if you talked to Danny Ainge about that.
He seems pretty fulfilled. He's a huge family man. So this was an interesting story. So he was coaching the Phoenix Suns, and he said, I didn't even set out to be a coach of the Phoenix Suns, but he got asked to be the coach. And basically, I think he was into his second year or his third year, and he has a lot of kids. So he's from the Mormon faith. And so I think that really grounds him. You could tell just his character and even willingness to talk to us like that. You could tell he's a good guy. But he basically quit from being the Phoenix Suns coach because he was away from his kids too much.
Whoa.
And so that's when he ended up being an executive of Boston. And he said that gave him, he said it was more hours, but more flexibility. So he could be, you know, he could go to his son's practice. He could go to a game and just work outside of that. And so he actually quit a job most everyone would die for to be there for his family, which for me, I was like, that's legit.
It's interesting for the layperson, because when we read the newspaper, or I guess it'd be the internet nowadays, we see a coach who's quitting to spend more time with his family. Usually that's bullshit, right?
Oh, yeah.
Usually that's not the reason.
Yeah, it's a cover. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But in his case,
decided to part ways type thing. Yeah.
Yeah,
it was impressive, man. I think anyone that can walk away from something like that, I mean, shows they're super grounded. And I think that proved to me that he at least had that aspect of it.
Wasn't he one of the best high school athletes ever?
You can make the argument he's the greatest high school athlete of all time.
I read that he was an All-American in three sports.
Yeah.
And maybe the first one ever.
I think he's the only three-time high school All-American in three different sports. So it's baseball, basketball, and football.
And where did he play?
He went to BYU.
What about high school?
Oh, he's from Eugene. So I don't know the exact high school, but he's from Eugene, Oregon.
So that probably further enhanced your experience. Y'all are from the same part of the country.
Yeah, trust me. I tried to plug every single connection we had, because I didn't want to be just some random guy that's peppering him from questions. I'm like, how can I find some connections? So the first one was my grandpa. I was like, this at least puts me at some sort of like, he knows who my grandpa is. And then, yeah, like when he mentioned he was, because I forgot he was from Eugene. He said that my coach was kind of a legend. Luke Jackson played at University of Oregon and was my coach in college. So I tried to bring that up as a connection. So
you played for Luke Jackson? I didn't know that.
Yeah, Luke Jackson, man.
No way.
Yeah. Yeah, he was the reason I ended up at NCU.
Huh.
Solely for him as a coach, yeah.
Did you have aspirations of playing in Italy or something if it couldn't be the NBA?
Yeah, I think I had the opportunity to. I think I dealt with a lot of injuries. I had hip surgery. I honestly, the surgeon basically told me I probably shouldn't come back to playing basketball after my sophomore year. I tore my labrum in my hip. It was basically a year recovery to get back onto the court. But in my mind, there was just no other option to – like, it was all that I knew and all I wanted to do. And so, but I think that kind of started this process just from like being injured and beat up that, you know, by the time I was at my senior year, I was stretching an hour a day. Like, I had aches and pains, and I was only 23 years old. And so for me, I just didn't have it in me to keep doing that, to maybe try to like climb the ladder in Europe. Cause you're not, unless you're a top D1 athlete, probably, or, you know, well known athlete, you're probably starting near the bottom. And you're having to grind your way up. And there's crazy stories. Luke was telling me when he was playing in Israel that if they lost, like, they would just shut off the hot water. They would just do crazy stuff. And I knew someone who was owed like tens of thousands of dollars where the team just dissolved and the owner just went ghost, never paid him money. So there's just a lot of stuff like that. I'm not saying that's everywhere, but I just, to me, it didn't entice me at the time. You know, in hindsight, should I have to go travel and have an opportunity? Like, maybe you can make that case, but I'm happy where I'm at. But yeah, I mean, I definitely had aspirations to do that. And I think I could have. I just chose not to.
Were you a three-time All-American also?
I was not a three-time. I was one-time All-American my senior year.
That's pretty impressive.
Yeah.
Who's your favorite basketball player ever?
I think it's twofold. I would say, first off, my grandpa. So my grandpa was three-time All-American at Purdue. He won a gold medal with the 1960 Olympic team with Jerry West, Oscar Robertson, Jerry Lucas, considered the original dream team. So that team got inducted to the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame. So my grandpa's in the Naismith Basketball Hall of Fame, which is crazy. And then he was a three-time All-Star. His first 3 years in the NBA was, or 4 years, was three-time All-Star and Rookie of the Year. And obviously that's my grandpa. So like, he gets the cake for sure. But I would say the player that had the most impact on me was Kobe Bryant.
Really?
The late, great Kobe Bryant. 100%. Yeah, just his mindset. And just his dedication to the game, like, it, I think there's so many people that could say that. Everyone talks about the Mamba mentality, but I think that dedication to greatness and that commitment to greatness, like, I feel like elevated so many athletes. So I feel like his commitment elevated me and, like, moved me emotionally. Like, you just, like, just that commitment to the game, his intensity. I mean, I remember when he passed, like, I cried personally just because of who he was to me as a player. But yeah, I loved Kobe.
Did you ask Ainge about Kobe?
I did.
What did he say?
He gave a different answer than most people do. And I think it was an objective right answer, where I think a lot of people, because I think I asked, I forget the exact question I asked, but basically competitors, winners, most competitive. So he mentioned Michael Jordan, obviously. He mentioned, I think, John Stockton, Jason Kidd. I don't know if he mentioned Larry. And then I kind of was added on as in Kobe. He goes, well, Kobe was kind of different. Because Kobe, from the time he came to the NBA, his goal was to be the greatest of all time. And he said for a while, for a lot of his career, his coaches didn't like him, his teammates didn't like him, which I think is well documented. That is well documented, that he had a lot of friction early on in his career, but then he grew into this person at the end of his career. Like, we saw, he's probably the first time we've seen a player from, like, coming to the league as a kid and leave as an adult. And I feel like he won so many people in that process because he matured so much, especially after what happened in Colorado with the allegations. I feel like that was like a switch for him, and I feel like he definitely changed from there on. But yeah, it was a different answer. I think, yeah, ultimately it was like he got to that, but I feel like he had a different narrative arc than some of those other guys.
Yeah, it makes you wonder, because of inflation, he spent $4 million on a ring after he cheated on his wife. Now
what is that? You're saying, oh, what he had to spend on that? Well,
yeah,
now.
It just makes you think. Like, if I cheated on my wife, I guess I'd have to give her like a $10 million ring, but then I'd adopt a Mamba mentality and I'd just be a killer.
Yeah. Huh? I mean, it might be something to it, man. You could try a case study. We'll see.
These retreats would get better and better. What's your take on Zion Williamson? Because I'm from the New Orleans area, and he's left-handed like yourself. I haven't heard anything about him lately. What's going on with him? Do you know?
I mean, word on the streets, I'm a better dunker than Zion Williamson.
You could dunk, huh?
Yeah, not even close to Zion Williamson.
But you could?
Yeah, I wasn't a high flyer. I was a shooter. So why score 2 points when you can score three? It's my mindset.
Because maybe you look like Matt Bullard. He was so I was a Rockets fan in the 90s.
Talking Matt Bonner?
No, or this is Matt a different Bullard.
Guy. Oh, okay, I don't know.
Yeah, he was on the team with Vernon Maxwell, Otis Thorpe, Hakeem Olajuwon, Robert Horry.
Oh, yeah, Big Shot Bob.
Yeah, so Jordan retired, gave us a shot to win, and we did 2 years. In fact,
you went back-to-back, right?
They did, and in the first one, they had to pause the game so that the white Bronco could be chased down the highway.
Oh, for OJ.
Yes.
Do you think that would happen nowadays? Would they stop an NBA game for...
Oh, yeah.
You think
even
they would?
More so.
Really?
Yeah, because the NBA is not as important to viewers. They're looking for ratings and a high-speed
chase. That's
true.
That's a good point. That's a good point.
That's all I have.
What'd you think of Hakeem?
Good points. The Dream?
Yeah.
The Dream Shake?
Yeah. How good was he? I feel like he gets slept on.
Well, if I was an executive, I would have taken Sam Bowie in that draft. But
hey, shout out Blazers, man. That's a great pick. So what we did in the Blazers organization history, we've had some good draft picks. We took Sam Bowie over Michael Jordan, which is a huge miss. Because we already had Clyde Drexler. I get the understanding behind it, but... You take Michael there, and then we picked Greg Oden over Kevin Durant.
And Clyde is not a threat. Clyde isn't a threat. That's what Jordan said on the last
Clyde's
dance.
Oh, Clyde's not a threat. Yeah. Yeah, I mean, Clyde's a top 75 player all time. He's not Michael Jordan, but I feel bad, man. Greg Oden would have been a Hall of Fame center, but yeah, two big men with injuries, and we could add KD and Michael Jordan.
Yeah. Greg Oden looked like he was my age in his 40s as a rookie, and that probably didn't help him. Yeah, so Clyde Drexler was on Phi Slamma Jamma, and UH had a chance to repeat this. Well, repeat after my entire life. I think it was like 40 years ago that they won, and then they had a chance to win it again. Did you follow it this year?
Yeah, 100%. Yeah, I was into it, yeah.
I thought that final was... Dude, all those games. What was it? The Elite Eight game where Florida came back. They were down 9 with 3 minutes and 13 seconds left. And then it seemed like they were outdone by the next later in the tournament.
Do you like Cinderella stories?
Of course.
You do?
I always root for the underdog. In fact, I'm the guy that messes up. My bracket is screwed after day two because I like to pick 3 out of 4 12s to beat a 5 and mix in a 13 to beat a 4 because I want to be that guy that picks the
the upset.
The 11 seed in the final 4 like LSU was when I was a kid.
I think my opinion, I don't like Cinderellas. I don't like them. My thing is these are the top teams all year and I want to see them play each other. So for me, everyone, I heard this on a podcast.
I don't like chocolate.
Everyone loves the Cinderella until it ruins their Saturday and they have to watch someone get smacked by 30. I do think there's something to having all 4-1 seeds in the final four in the games that we got. Like, to me, that's more entertaining. I'd rather see the top teams in the Elite Eight. Maybe get some early upsets. That's fine. But you get to the final four, like, I want to see the best teams play the best teams. I think that's why this was such a good final four. I think you had 4 really good teams battling it out and you got the games that you got.
I don't want to say it's fitting coming from a good-looking 6'5" guy, but as an under 6-footer, I don't like to hear you say that.
Hey, man. I mean, it got to a point where I wasn't one of those guys either, but like, I still want to see the best teams play the best teams.
Yeah.
Personally.
Whatever, dude. What are you most excited about? I'm switching gears here, but you're about to get married and have a family. What most excites you about getting married and the idea of having a family?
It's a good question. I think for me, there were certain things growing up that were hard that I went through with my family. And so there was a certain environment, family that I don't want to say like family. I love my family, but I think there were certain things I wanted to do differently. And so ever since I would say probably college, one of my main driving forces in life has been I want to have a family to kind of have at times what I didn't have growing up. And that's always been a huge driver for me. And so I'm just really excited, man. I think, you know, when I look at a relationship and a marriage, obviously there's happiness, there's joy. Like, you never marry someone that's not going to make you happy and joy. So that's off the table, right? So that's always included of what comes with marriage. But I think the biggest blessing, because this is the longest relationship I've ever been in by far. And so, you know, I think what's been a huge blessing is just the growth that I feel like comes from marriage, right? Who that's going to make me to be. So, you know, I've heard different pastors say this is, you know, ultimately what marriage is, it's a covenant, but the goal is ultimately for you to grow into who God's created you to be. And it's an environment for you to do that. And so I think for me, I think I'm excited about that process of us growing together and working through things and how I'm going to grow in that. Obviously just creating a life with someone I think is really exciting. Of, you know, she's always been health conscious, but we even joke about or talk about and dream about, you know, having our sauna and our cold plunge. And, you know, you start to think about ways in which you're dreaming, but then also just having kids. Like, obviously, I don't know what it's like. I don't think you really know until you have a kid. But I think I've always been excited to be a dad. And I think, yeah, just create, you know, what I've always wanted. And my family's had a ton of redemption, but I'm really excited for that. And yeah, just creating a life and having something outside of myself to really invest into. I think that's such a awesome thing to be able to do, of have something that's more important than yourself. I think that in and of itself is going to be a huge blessing. So yeah, there's a lot. I'm excited for it.
What would you say you didn't get that you will most implement with your own family?
Yeah, and who knows where life goes, right? Like, you have your vision of what you want family to look like, and I'm sure it's going to look different, but I mean, my mom had a lot of health challenges growing up. So, I mean, I could kind of go down the list. Fibromyalgia, she had breast cancer, she was an alcoholic. She's now been sober for 7 years. She had some mental health. Yeah, praise God. It's unbelievable, man. I think the testament to get sober, man, like someone who can do that. I mean, I have the utmost respect for someone like that. But yeah, alcoholic, she had some mental health issues. And there was just a lot of that where... And I've told this story before, and she knows, and she's fine with me telling it, but there was a time where I think it was an interaction with a antidepressant medication, and she really went down off the ledge and basically took a bunch of sleeping pills trying to take her life. And so I had to walk in and basically try to keep her awake until the ambulance came, but I was so mad at her, I literally walked out of the room knowing that she could die, and I was fine with that. So there was so much anger and just and I think my dad tried to do his best to cope with it. And he kind of was distant, dealing with it himself. And so I think there wasn't that like lovey, communal feeling in my family. And we've come so far. Like, I think God's had his hand on it the whole way. And it's been really cool, the redemption that's happened. But I think a lot of that where there was just wasn't that really close, tight-knit, doing stuff together. Like, I feel like at times I kind of raised myself emotionally myself, or kind of, you know, I was cooking dinners for my family where when my mom was in bed. So kind of all that stuff that I feel like I had to kind of like grow up early. So I think, you know, creating that environment that I feel like we're getting to as a family, which is really cool. But, you know, to give that to my kids and to stop generational patterns and, you know, kind of to write a different story, I think is what I've been really excited about.
If she were listening to this, would any of this be new to her? Or she knows about what you just said about how she was dying, the ambulance was coming, you left the room?
I told her, yeah. So this was crazy because I told my mom this. I said, there was a time in my life where I thought my life would have been better had you died.
Say more.
Little bro. So it was a long journey, man. But I think one of the biggest things that I was really mad about was, and ultimately, I think through that process, I started to live from the lie that I was unlovable. I didn't know it. It was like a subconscious thing I was running from. But I think some of it, a lot of it probably stemmed from that whole interaction growing up. You know, even just the moment of like, hey, and my mom's doing so much better now. So like, this is me speaking from a place of like incredibly proud of her. And we've built such a better relationship, which is only, I feel like only God could do that. But, you know, I think she was definitely struggling. And yeah, I think one of the biggest things that shifted for me, because I didn't know if I ever wanted to reconcile. I thought maybe for my kids, I didn't want to have complete distance, but I never had a goal of reconciling with her. And a lot of my family, I kind of just wanted to keep my distance because, you know, I think people, maybe it's the alcoholic personality that sometimes you have to stay pretty even keel because you don't want to rock the boat. So if I rocked the boat, occasionally sometimes that would cause her to drink. So I felt kind of a pressure that I had to not rock the boat. And so I would be very shut down around them. So I just didn't really want to be around them. It's still hard for me to even make eye contact with them. Like, I'm growing that trust, but I wouldn't even make eye contact with my parents. I would look down. I just tried to stay in my own little bubble. But the thing is, where I came to, where I was like, okay, if I want to be who I want to become and I want to do the things in life I want to do, I have to forgive. Like, if I don't want to like repeat generational stuff and pass this down to my kids and all the stuff that happened, I have to deal with this. The only thing, I didn't know how to deal with it. I didn't know how to forgive. Like, how do you know when you've forgiven someone? Is it when you say it? Is it when you feel it? Like, I had no idea how to navigate that whole thing. And so a lot of it was kind of a big move of God in my life, where I had some people really invest into me and just kind of showed me some things in scripture I'd never seen before. Because I think one of the biggest things that I was mad at her about was, I felt like she had taken something from me. Because she had taken something from me, I was living from a place of lack, and I was mad at her for that transaction. That I was then didn't have something that, if I would have had a loving mother at certain times, I don't want to say not a loving mother, a present mother, that I would have been differently. And I think it showed up in relationships, where I felt like I had a really hard time dating because I just didn't know how to navigate like the anxiety and the fear of abandonment and all that stuff. And so it hurt my dating relationships. So I was like, man, will I ever be able to like figure this thing out? Right? Which is such a beautiful blessing. I'm now engaged. But yeah, I just didn't know. But ultimately, like, some friends show me, there's a verse in Ephesians 1. And as we mentioned, my faith guides me. It's such a paramount to who I am. But it says, you've been blessed with every spiritual blessing in the heavenly places. Basically, you've been given everything. So I was operating from a place of lack, thinking I'd lost something. But then I came to the realization that, like, Jesus gave me all these things freely. So those things that I thought I had lost, like unlovable, I'm loved. Like, you've been given a spirit of, not a fear, but power and love and of a sound mind. So the anxiety that I was mad that probably came from my relationship, I realized like that was not my identity. And so then one of the main reasons I was mad at my mom for was ill-founded, because she didn't take anything from me because I had it. So then one of the reasons why I was not mad at her, or I was mad at her, left. So that was a big thing for me. But it was crazy, man. I went through this period. I was reading a ton of books just trying to figure out myself and grow. And I was reading this book talking about generational trauma and how things get passed down and all that. And I was reading in this book talking about, hey, imagine the person you feel like has hurt you the most, and imagine all their pain, all their hurt, things they've been through. Because I think part of it was, my grandpa was incredibly successful, but I think he had a propensity to get very hyper-focused and fixated on what he was doing. So his job, basketball, and so obviously moving a lot too with him playing, because, you know, you move to different teams, she moves. So I think, yeah, obviously that affected her. And so I kind of saw her for who she was finally, like scars and all, and why she was the way that she was. And I just like broke down and just like started sobbing in my apartment by myself, just crying. And I was like, I need to act on this right now. So I texted her. I said, Mom, can we get lunch today? I don't even know how I'm going to bring this up, but I have to tell her. Because in that moment where I saw her, I couldn't even conjure up negative feelings about her. Where I went from a place where I literally wanted you to die and I wish you would have died because then I wouldn't have had to deal with this. To then, like, I can't even conjure, even now, I can't even conjure up what those feelings were. I can't even find anger for her. And so I called her and we go to this, it's called the Laughing Planet. It's like a healthy Chipotle. So we're sitting there in the corner and we're just kind of talking. And she's probably wondering why, because I never just initiated getting food or getting together. And somehow it came up. I was like, I feel like this is going to get brought up somehow. I don't know how. And I feel like God made a way for that to happen. I said, Mom, look, like, I used to live from a place and thought this, and me and my sister would talk about it. We thought our lives would have been better had you died. I said, I'm not saying this from a place of pride. Like, this is just reality. But I'm sitting across from you right now, and I can't even conjure up feelings of anger towards you. And it was like a pretty redemptive moment where, like, we cried, we hugged. But it was a thing I never really, like, planned to do. Until I realized that it was going to hold me back in life, right? And so then I had to, and then ultimately it was a God thing. Like, I don't know if I could have gotten there myself personally. And so, yeah, it's crazy. I think now, like, we just went to Disney for 4 days where, like, spending time with my mom 4 days, me and her, would have, like, conjured up a ton of anxiety. I probably would have found a way to shorten it. It wouldn't have been that fun. And we had a good time. Spent 4 days together.
I can relate.
Yeah. I know, so, that's why you're big bro.
Would you say your ability to work through your fear of abandonment is, would you attribute that to your relationship with God?
Yeah. Because I think the fear of abandonment is centered in some sort of lie. Like, there's some lie, because ultimately you always act out who you believe that you are. And like, when you look at the identity loop, it goes like identity, beliefs, thoughts, feelings, actions, and it cycles, right? So ultimately, at some point, there's some belief in there. And I think the lie that I figured out was holding me back, because basically I went to this pastor speaking, this church thing, and I got hit pretty hard. I just start crying at one of those talks out of nowhere, right? And ultimately, you know, we got to this point where the pastor was like, what's holding you back from receiving the freedom that the Bible claims that you have? There's some lie you're believing. On three, listed out. 3, 2, 1, I'm unlovable. I was like, whoa. Like, I didn't even know that's what I was operating from. Then I look back at my life, and that was like the driving force of like so much of why I tried to overachieve and gain affection and love. And if this girl will finally like me, then maybe I'll feel loved. Or if I succeed, then maybe I'll finally be loved. But it was never enough. And so I think the thing about the fear of abandonment was okay, I outsourced my identity and my worth to women so that I gave them the power to make me feel if I was loved or not. And so if they liked me, I felt loved. If they didn't, then I didn't feel loved. And that's like a very baseline. If you give your value and your worth to someone, you give them that power, then if they leave you, like, that's really scary. And so I think that was what was driving so much of that fear of abandonment was, I don't know if I'm lovable. And so if someone leaves me, it then validates that belief. And so, yeah, I think just knowing that I'm infinitely loved, like, it starts there. Like, there was a moment, it wasn't like a magical moment. After I found out that was the lie, I just rested. I eventually got to a point of rest. I burn out and I was like, you know, I'm just going to rest. It was during COVID, not much going on. And there was just a moment. I was just sitting outside and I was like, and I was, so much of what I did was to try to earn love. So I was a huge achiever. Mm-hmm. And I just randomly, I was sitting there. I was like, you know what? I could just sit on this log the rest of my life and I know I'm loved. And then I feel like that was kind of the then set the foundation now for me to like grow in that fear of abandonment and then have a healthy relationship. But until that happened, I think it would have just been a repeated cycle all the time.
You said that as you think about getting married, you talk about good health and cold plunges and saunas. You already own a sauna, don't you?
I own a portable sauna, yeah.
Yeah?
Yeah.
What is that? Tell me about it.
My fiance will probably say I buy too many things, too many gadgets. It's something I'm passionate about. I love it. And I've been, you know, working through some health stuff myself. But yeah, I think if you look at sauna, like the health benefits are crazy. So I think 4 to 7 times a week, your all carbs mortality drops by like 62%, which is pretty significant. I think it's cardiovascular, but like sweating out toxins. Toxins are one of the main thing that leads to like aging and all this dysfunction that happens in the body. So yeah, so basically it's an infrared sauna, near and far infrared. But it's interesting because some studies, and maybe some can correct me on this and tell me I'm wrong, but I've read that you detox 7 times greater than a traditional Finnish sauna, because basically the light gets in and gets to actually your cells, and that's where a lot of toxins store. So like it's actually releasing toxins from your cells, from your fat cells. And there's a lot of benefits of like mitochondrial health. But yeah, I sit in my corner, I have my TV right in front of me, my head sticks out, so I look like a goober. I sent you a selfie, and you were like, why are you sending me a selfie? And it was from it was from the sauna. And yeah, I just sit there 20, 30 minutes a day and just sweat it out a little bit. And it's, I love it, man. It's euphoric.
How long do you stay in there?
20 to 30, maybe 40 minutes, depending upon the day.
And would you pay for it?
Bid about $1,000.
$1,000? And you use it 4 to 7 times a week?
I use it 7 times a week.
Do you ever think, so I wouldn't disagree with you about its benefits, but do you ever think there's a correlation, that it might just be a correlation between people who are healthy anyway? Because it takes a certain person to discipline themselves to go into the sauna and have the free time. So you have to be prosperous enough to not only have access to a sauna, but you're probably successful enough to have enough leisure time to get in there. You see what I'm saying? Like,
yeah. Maybe, but that. I think when you look at what the sauna like causes your body to go through, I think there's enough even just anecdotal evidence that sweating out toxins is going to be beneficial for you. Working your cardiovascular system, red light helps with inflammation. All those things lead to aging and disease. So like even if you're just looking at that, I think it's beneficial. But yeah, I would assume – I haven't looked at the actual data of the studies, but I would assume they try to account for that.
Yeah, I'm just saying I don't know many overweight losers that go to the sauna. I go to the sauna regularly. I never see some
– That's a good point. But even if you're getting healthy people who are working out a lot and they're – you compare them to a placebo or a group that's not doing it and there's that benefit, I think that's enough of a sample size. But yeah, could be wrong. Agree.
I'm curious, how do you invest your money now? I know we've talked a lot about it, but for listeners, and I'm curious to get an update.
Yeah, it's something I've had to really grow in, and just understanding how to invest money, because I was taught growing up to save but not really how to invest. And so I've learned a ton from you, obviously. I think my house, right, like that was an investment. It wasn't – I mean, it's nice having a house, but I was fine being in an apartment. But it was, yeah, how can I build equity? I'm spending money anyways. Like what if I just built equity? So the house was a big one. I think I put a lot of money, especially right now with the stock market being so volatile – like I think eventually, I think that's – there's enough track history, right, that eventually it goes up and to the right. So, you know, I think right now with my age of being 30, you know, I have like a money market account that, you know, I kind of use as like a savings account. But most of it I'm just putting into VTSAX with Vanguard. So I have most of my money in that, you know, with my age, and just letting that run its course and compound interest. But, you know, I think me and Elise, my fiance, have talked about owning – like she owns 2 properties right now herself. She's a realtor. And so, you know, we've talked about, you know, obviously buying properties, and because that's a world she knows. But yeah, so that 401k through work, those are the main ones.
Are you going to live with her prior to tying the knot?
No.
No? I didn't either. We traveled together, but didn't live together. Going back to basketball a minute, that Anthony Edwards fella is fun to watch. Do you think he'll someday be mentioned in the breath, same breath as like Jordan, Kobe?
I think people are trying to force it.
Force it.
I think people are trying to crown him with that too early. But I think he shows up. There's certain moments where you're like, that's MJ-esque. Like his scoring ability, the intensity he plays with, his defense. Like he kind of brings that, like you watch him and you feel that thing you felt watching Kobe and MJ. I mean, he definitely could, man. I mean, he's turned into – he was one of only 3 players in the NBA to make over 300 three-pointers this year at his athleticism at 23 years old. Yeah, I mean, the sky's the limit for him. You know, we'll see what happens. He's got to win some championships, but I'm a huge Anthony Edwards fan. Yeah, I think he's going to be – he'll be a for sure Hall of Famer, and then we'll just – I think the championships will dictate where he ends up on the ladder.
It's funny to hear you talk about Kobe, because everybody your age talks about Kobe so much and how impacted they were even before he died. And as somebody who grew up with Michael Jordan, I always saw Kobe as an imitation. And then when he started getting in trouble off the court, I was like, well, Jordan never did that.
Yeah, I mean, obviously he was our MJ, right? Yeah. So I do think Kobe was a little more accessible with the content you got from him.
That because of the technological advances?
It could have been. I think Michael Jordan, just because of how big of a star he was, he isolated himself. Like, he just, he was so big that I think he shut off some of that stuff. I think it talks about that in The Last Dance. But I think Kobe, like, I've watched probably most of, not all of his interviews and just, like, his intellect and all that. So, I think there he was a little more accessible to people. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, I mean, ultimately, I grew up a little bit on Michael Jordan. My dad was a huge Bulls fan, but I was two his last year with the Bulls, so.
Did you ever ask your dad who was the toughest player he ever guarded?
My grandpa?
I'm sorry, your grandpa.
Tough player my dad ever guarded. I don't know. My dad did play at Harvard and Stanford.
Harvard and Stanford?
Yeah, that was my dad. So he that's went to my
two different schools?
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah, my dad did. So my grandpa was Purdue, but
oh, okay.
He said the greatest player he ever played against was Bill Russell.
I knew you were going to say that.
He said Bill Russell. Like, he said hands down, it wasn't even a debate, it was Bill Russell.
Does he think he's the greatest ever?
Yeah, he said he was the greatest ever. And obviously, he played against Bill. Like, he never played against MJ. He never played against LeBron. Like, you know, all those type of players. He played, actually, this was actually interesting. So, one day, I turned on Netflix for a while. Maybe it was NBA TV. Had, like, old school games. They had Kareem Abdul-Jabbar's first game. I'd never seen my grandpa play. And so, I turned it on. I'm kind of watching it. And I'm like, wait, 77? I think it was maybe 77. He was with Detroit at the time. And I was like, wait, I think my grandpa's playing in this game. So I turned it on and got to watch my grandpa play. So I'd never seen him play. There's not a lot of content from back then, right? Like recordings and stuff. But yeah, he's still Bill Russell. Just the way he, like, defensively just manipulated the game. And he won. He won, what, 11 championships in 13 years? I mean, he talked about Kareem. He said Wilt was just unbelievable. I feel like he played against Jerry West, obviously played on the Olympic team with him. But yeah, hands down said Bill Russell.
And this was 77, you said? Was he
out? I might be wrong. No, 77 was when the Blazers won the championship, I think. So it was before that. But I forget the exact year. Maybe 73.
Do you have any idea which year Lou Alcindor became Kareem?
Did that happen in Los Angeles?
Oh, I don't know. I'm asking you.
I don't know. I don't know when that change happened.
All right. You want to do fun questions?
Yeah. Let's go.
If you could create a new holiday that celebrates a unique aspect of human nature, what would it be?
A new holiday? What would you do?
Mine would probably be authenticity. Mm. Everybody's craving that nowadays. So if we put more of a focus on it, we might see less fakery. And I think that would create a better world. It would create a more harmonious social media existence for the world.
Yeah.
Yeah, and maybe quit the filters. It's all about authenticity.
That's a good one. Yeah, just genuineness. I think...
Were you giving yourself time to think, or were you genuinely curious about what...
I was curious, but it did give me time to think, so it was a win-win, but...
Usually, you would just say, that's a good question.
I think I did say that, and I threw it back. I think what comes to mind, honestly, is something around comedy. So I think everyone wants to laugh. I think there's so much power in laughter. And so I think there was a day for people just to take time out and whatever that is, if it's specials, if it's comedy shows, or just, you know, you kind of get a little bit with maybe April Fools, but I think comedy would be a good one.
I haven't laughed as much as I laughed last night in a long time. Did I tell you the story about the guy that was in the pool with one of our other guys and said, don't ever date or marry a woman with a child, because you will be raising that other man's sperm. And then later, the guy he was talking to looked like he was moping around, and I thought I should ask him if he's okay. And then he told me he was going for a walk, and I said, okay, you want to use the car? Because he wanted to go to the beach. The beach is kind of far. He said, yeah, I'll take you up on that. So we took the car, and then we were getting ready to eat, and he still wasn't back. So I texted him. I'm like, hey, man, you all right? And he seemed to be in better spirits when he got back. And then later that night, I'm talking to the guy who made the proclamation about the sperm. And he said, man, earlier I was at the pool and I said to him, don't ever raise another man's sperm. And then later tonight when we were doing our talks, I found out he's dating a woman. His girlfriend has a kid. She has a child. And I was like, oh, man, maybe that's why he was upset. And I looked at him and I thought he was going to say, I really shouldn't have done that. Instead, he goes, it was the right advice.
Did you ever think you would say the proclamation about the sperm?
I don't think I've ever used the word proclamation if it didn't rhyme with emancipation.
Yeah. That's something I didn't think I'd ever hear.
There's a first for everything.
There is.
as evidenced by us finally meeting after 500 hours on the phone.
It's crazy, man. It is weird. Like, I feel like I've known you, and I even meeting you, I feel like I've already met you. But yeah, it's wild to talk to someone weekly, close to daily, for 2.5 years. Yeah. And then you finally meet them. It's crazy.
Did I already ask you if you could switch lives with somebody? Who would it be? If on Monday you could wholesale swap lives with somebody just to see what their life is like, who would that person be?
I can't
be?
Say I wouldn't do that and just keep my life. It's
no,
just an exercise.
That's not a good answer, yeah.
I mean, you could go so many different routes like that with that. Like, would you want to be a world leader? Like, would you want to switch with the president? What was it like to be Donald Trump? Would be crazy. I don't know if I'd want to be Trump. I'm not saying I do, but that would be like a really fascinating thing just to be the leader of the country. Who's someone that I just would really love to be? I think. What about you?
Who'd you say? Oh, you need time to think? Mine would probably be Trump. I'd like to know what it... Well, it would be stressful. They age a lot as president, but he hasn't magically. Maybe it's because he's the first billionaire and he's got the money to pay for...
Maybe.
A spray tan every
day. I mean, this guy's
and...
got the spray tan going. Yeah. Who knows if he's... What else he's doing? Yeah, I don't know. That would just be interesting. I feel like what would it be like to walk down the street and people are either like so pumped to see you or they're just like, I hate you. Yeah, that would be crazy.
For that day, I'd make sure to schedule a rally so that I don't get
any hate. Oh, you get a rally? Yeah. It would probably be some athlete, I would say, like to play in the NBA. Or, you know, honestly, what would be really fun to do would be a performer, like a singer. Like, I wonder what that euphoric high is like when you're singing to people, like a whole stadium, and they're singing the song with you back. That's got to be a crazy experience.
That, to me, would be probably the biggest high. Would you party in the tour bus afterwards?
No.
No.
I don't think so. I don't know who I would even be, though. I don't know who's, like, a big star. Like, if you could be, like, a Elton John, but he's not even touring anymore. I don't know who that current male star is. Bieber's kind of in the hindsight. Ed Sheeran, maybe?
Oh, yeah, that's a good
one. Ed Sheeran would be a big one.
He played my wife and I's song for our first dance at our wedding. What is that song called?
He played it, or you played
his
song?
Yeah, he was there. I hired him. No, I played
it's like,
it on
that's
the radio.
Crazy. I was like, how did you not told this story before? What song was it?
The slow one where you just dance in circles. What is it? I hope my wife isn't going to watch this. I don't remember the song now.
My buddy had a... Ed Sheeran song it was Tenerife Sea, but I don't know if that was the one that you
I can know. I'm playing the melody in my head. It's something like You're Beautiful or something about tonight. I can't believe I can't remember it.
I do like Ed Sheeran though.
I do too.
I'll tap into it. Tap into the emotion.
Is there a book that's most impacted your life?
Easy answer is the Bible has been the most impactful book, but I think a book that probably people haven't heard of that much. It was called The Ruthless Elimination of Hurry. It was by my pastor from back in Portland, John Mark Comer, where that's my bent is I have a tendency to rush and be too hurried and busy. And so there's a story he starts the book with. So there's this pastor, theologian, his name is Dallas Willard. He's kind of the grandfather, whatever you would call it, of like spiritual disciplines within Christianity. And this guy, John Ortberg, who was a big voice in that as well and still is, was apprenticing under him, or he was mentoring him. And he goes, what is needed to live a spiritually healthy life? Dallas Willard sat there for a second. And he goes, you must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. And he's like, awesome, cool, writes it down. Okay, yeah, that's awesome. What else? He goes, there is nothing else. Mm. You must ruthlessly eliminate hurry from your life. And it came at a point in my life, like, I feel like there's certain books that just come into your life. You're like, this was what I needed at this time. And that's happened a few times in my life. But I think that one has stuck with me of, like, if you're living so rushed, like, there was a quote that says, I think it was Corey Ten Boom, like, if God can't make you sin, he'll make you busy. Where it's really impossible to live a joyful, peaceful, happy life when you're always busy and rushed. It's like they don't coexist. And so I think for me, that was a really impactful book to just realize how much hurry, how does it affect us, and how has it grown in our society? Even back to when like 7-Eleven, there used to be on the weekend, you couldn't even go to a grocery store. Like everything was closed. But then 7-Eleven, because so there's like all these things that started to like hurry us up as a society. Now it's just so fast paced. So that was a really impactful book for me.
I read that book. Did you recommend it to me? Because if you didn't, it was Jesse. Did Jesse
recommend it
to
you? No, it
was
probably me.
It was probably you.
Yeah, it's probably
got a
me.
Red
yeah.
cover.
I love that book, man. It was a good book.
Cool. What's the coolest thing anybody's ever done for you? Not like the kindest, but the coolest. Like, oh God, this is so cool. That's the best thing ever.
Not the kindest.
Not the kindest, but the coolest.
Coolest thing.
They're probably, it could be both.
Man, I'm trying to think the coolest thing someone's ever done for me. It's a tough question. It's a good question.
You want me to skip it?
No, I want you. Have you answered this question?
Yeah.
Any other time you have?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, okay.
I told the story earlier when I was playing at Baylor, what my best man did for me.
Oh, yeah, that was cool.
That was the coolest.
I feel like it's a recency thing, but basically my fiance's dad has been going through a lot of health challenges, found out he had T-cell lymphoma, and so there was a moment where things were looking kind of rough, and I was texting everyone in my phone, and there was people, like a group of people, a couple people that literally within the hour they said, hey, we're going to set up a prayer call. I mean, it was on a Friday evening. They didn't have to do that. But like in that moment with like what we were going through, that someone would be like, you know what, you're important enough and we care enough about you in the situation and want to like bless you in this way, that they scheduled a Zoom, like a Google Meets call, and prayed with us for an hour. And just to see how encouraging that was to Elise meant a lot. And yeah, it moved me to tears on the call. I was like, and I don't normally cry like that, but it made me so emotional. It was like one of the, yeah, I would say kindest, but just it was really cool to have someone show up that way, like so willingly in my life. It was cool.
You know, I've always said that example, I've used that experience playing at Baylor as my coolest moment. But when my wife surprised me on my 40th birthday, she had been pregnant for like 3 months and hit it.
Oh, yeah. You did tell that story.
Yeah, that probably takes the cake.
Yeah. Haven't had that happen. Thank God.
And, you know, I've had that experience when I was going through the worst of my health issues early last year. I had my wife's relatives call from Mexico, and it was a bunch of her aunts and cousins, and they all prayed for me.
Oh,
and you're
awesome.
Right. It's like, I would compare it to, I was once surprised for my 30th birthday. Somebody threw a surprise birthday party for me, and I just floated. I felt like I was floating, and I was too overwhelmed to even think, like, how did you get here? And how didn't I know that you were coming to town? Because you drove from 5 hours away. And so it's comparable to that feeling of, like, overwhelm. And just overwhelm with an awesome feeling that somebody would do that for you.
Yeah, I don't even know if I could put it into words, like, the feeling that I felt. Like, I think that's the best way you can show up for someone. Personally, like, when you're going through something like that, to be so selfless and, like, you're in such a vulnerable position to, like, be there in that capacity. Like, yeah, it's really touching.
Well, what's the best piece of advice you've ever received? It could be from anybody. Maybe your dad or grandpa or...
It's hard. I haven't had many good coaches in my life. Life coaches in my life.
Okay, so that you don't feel bad about not saying me. What's the best piece of advice you've ever received from anybody over the age of 44?
Yeah, I think probably one of the best advice I ever had was, like, when you're considering who you're taking advice from, like, look at their life and are they actually successful in the arena in which they're giving advice? Because I think a lot of people that go to their parents for financial advice or for relationship advice, it's like, well, your parents have been divorced twice and they're struggling financially, but then you go to your parents for financial advice. And so I think that wasn't something I ever considered. Really, like, I didn't always go to my parents for advice, just given some of the stuff I referenced earlier, but I do think that that kind of shifted me of, and again, why I was even more willing to even go into coaching was, okay, who's someone like yourself that is ahead of where I'm at? They've done some things. So obviously there's a blueprint that I can follow and let me learn from them. Like, how do they do it? How do they think? Like, and so I think that got me to kind of understand mentorship and who I'm getting advice from. So I would say that probably that's the first one that comes to my mind. I'm sure there's something else too, but that was a good one.
And you would work with a coach who wasn't even 6 feet tall?
I didn't know that. It was remote. And I showed up and I saw you and I'm like, man, I don't know if this is going to work out.
So we mentioned Donald Trump earlier. If you had his ear one morning in the Oval, just you and him, what piece of advice, if he said, Michael, you got any advice for me? What piece of advice would you give him?
I just feel like be authentic.
You don't feel like he is?
I don't think he is. I feel like he's playing a character because basically, so one of my best friends, his dad is the ambassador to he was the ambassador to Portugal, got knighted. Now he just got made under Trump's administration the ambassador to, I think it's maybe Japan.
He got made. He's a made man.
He's a made man. He got, what would you even, appointed? Appointed the position? Whatever. And like, I've heard stories from him of like, he's like, Trump's the nicest guy. He always asks about my family. And I just feel like, on this isn't my endorsement, I just wish like he would give more. I think he's given that at certain times. And I think people want to see that. Because he's like, so, I feel like he gets on stage and he's talking points. He just says the same stuff over on podcasts. He would get on, he would just say the same talking points over and over. And I'm like, I can't listen to this. But I feel like anytime I've seen him be authentic, whether you agree with him or not, I feel like people, like you said, their authenticity have a day of that. I feel like it's, especially in politics, that's just gone out the window. And I think that's what people want. And so I would tell him just be authentic and like explain why you do what you do. I don't think he's, we were talking about that earlier. I don't think he's good at explaining why he's doing what he's doing. So he leaves a void, whether it's like good or not good. I think he leaves a void for people to fill in. So like, tell us with this tariff thing, like why, what's the reasoning behind it? What's the logistics? What are you hoping to happen? Like, I feel like he doesn't give that. And so I think that I would like to know, like, tell me why, like, let me learn. And I don't think he does a good job at that. So those are probably the two things that come to mind.
Do you and your fiance agree politically?
I would say topic by topic. I mean, this was a really tough election to navigate through. My biggest thing is how I process information. So I'm really trying to do a good job of like, okay, how do I try to learn from both sides? And like, what do I actually believe? Filter in, what is this side thing? What is this side thing? But I think it was hard because like when people, like, she had things that were really important to her in this election, which rightfully so. But I think you get put, like, I think most people, we both like more or less agree on positions on certain topics. But I think like with the current environment, you're then forced into like two very polarizing parties. So yeah, I think we had to learn how to communicate through some of that stuff. And I had to learn, I think my issue is I love being devil's advocate. And we've talked about this a little bit of like, sometimes you don't have to do that. Sometimes you can just agree. And I think that's where, I don't even think we disagree on stuff. I think I would sometimes create issues because I would try to be devil's advocate and then that would create problems. So yeah, I think it was a growth experience, but yeah, I think it's just such a polarizing time. I think it was just a tough thing to navigate.
If there was anyone in your life that you could recommend to attend this retreat next time, who would it be?
Recommend attend this retreat.
Who would most benefit that you know?
I think you can go a lot of ways with that. Like, I think certain people can really benefit who are like going through tough times and then be around a lot of inspiring people. I think you could go that route. Who would, man? Like, I have a buddy right now who, like, he's been, first time he's been 3 months, now almost 4 months sober from alcohol after like 10 years. Like, he started early. I think someone like that would really benefit from just being around people and just being inspired. There's some people I can think from back home in Nashville. I have a group. I feel like I could hand select a bunch of guys from my Bible study that I'm in that would really benefit. But I don't know if I have an exact name. I feel like I could go a lot of ways with that one. Do you want an actual name?
No.
Okay.
Not if one doesn't come to you with 2 minutes worth of answering my question.
What would you call an external processor? That was me externally processing.
You know, one thing I'm curious about, I used to ask this question on the pod, but I haven't asked it in a while. If you could go anywhere in the world for 30 days, where would it be?
Costa Rica. No. We're here right now. I would probably go, usually go in the States. I would say probably somewhere in Europe. Actually, does my safety not, like, I'm going to be safe wherever I go?
Yeah. I mean, if it's funny, we talked about this yesterday. I've taken people to Prague, for example, and they came up out of the subway into what's called Wenceslas Square, which is one of the main squares, and they looked around and they said, I feel safer here than in New Orleans. And I was like, of course.
Yeah.
This is way safer than New Orleans. I think there's only 9 places in the world that per capita have a higher rate than New Orleans, and they're all near the border of Mexico and the United States.
But if safety doesn't matter, I think like that's not a consideration. I feel like going to North Korea would be very interesting.
Oh, God. That's not Europe.
No, I know. I pivoted a little bit.
Pivoted.
Yeah. But wouldn't that be interesting if like literally like you could be safe and you could just observe?
You'd have to be guaranteed safety.
Well, that's
what
I'm saying.
It would be a propaganda tour. So I've even considered it, of course.
But this is all entire hypothetical, where like you can just go live as a local.
Yeah.
It would be really fascinating, because that place is so protected. But outside of that, I would say somewhere like Budapest, or you've talked about Prague enough. I think Prague would be awesome. I feel like London would be really cool. So I feel like somewhere in Europe.
Have you planned your honeymoon?
So honeymoon will be in Hawaii. Okay. So my grandma's held the timeshare in Hawaii, even though she doesn't travel, because she wants the grandkids to be able to use it for honeymoons. So that'll be a blessing. It's a free trip. But we are planning to go to Europe this fall. So that'll be more of like a exploratory trip.
Cool.
Yeah.
This was a long time in the making, little bro.
Long time, big bro. This. I'm glad, man. It's an honor to be on the podcast, man. I obviously look up to you a lot, and it's I think that's one thing that's cool too, is obviously we only talk one-on-one. To then like see you interact with other people and just like in this environment, I think it's made me more honored to like have you as a coach and then also be considered little bro. So yeah, man, it's been a huge blessing, and
yeah,
it's been fun.
I saved you one of the better rooms with a balcony. I even put one guy on the couch so that you could have this room, and you came a day later than everybody.
Yeah, no, that's much appreciated for sure.
Yeah, so I won't get mushy. I'll just say I did all that for you.
Yeah, no, I mean that actions speak louder than words. So I appreciate it.
Thank you, buddy.
Yeah, of course.
Love it.
Yeah.
Thank you, friends. If you enjoyed this podcast, I should ask you, if somebody wanted to contact you, how could they do it?
Contact me. I'm on and off Instagram. I would say probably LinkedIn, Michael Loomis, LOOMIS, and then probably Facebook. Probably be the two.
That's what the last guy said. Thank you, folks. I appreciate you listening. If we can do anything for you, let us know. I can be found. I'm Man Overseas. I think there's an underscore between man and overseas on the social. Thank y'all. Bye-bye.